Botellitas de Jerez, Botellita de Jerez with Guadalupe. And that'll about do it for Radio Free Chico this week. And so stay tuned for Peace and Social Justice right now. Bye-bye.
Say it again. Nothing. This is Chris. The show is called Peace and Justice, and we're on with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1. We will be talking somewhat about war in this next segment. I just wanted to say something since it's Black History Month. I just want to tell you a little bit about Edmund Starr, who sings that song so eloquently. He was born January 21st in 42. His name was Charles Edwin Hatcher. He was born in Nashville but grew up in Cleveland. He was famous for his Motown singles in the 70s, especially this song, which was number one in 1970 on the charts. The war in Vietnam, of course, didn't end until 5 years later, but it had an effect. It was a very, very powerful statement of where the country was at. He did 11 albums through his life. He was married and had a child, and he spent most of his adult life in England. He moved there in 83 and produced a lot of music there, and died there in 2003. He did serve time in the U.S. Army. He was drafted in 1960 and served 3 years. It doesn't look like he went to Vietnam. He was in Germany. But it was the first Motown single, really, to make a political statement. So in terms of Black history and American history, we thank you, Edmund Starr. And let me get back to you here with the interview I wanted to conduct today with a former co-host. He's Professor Emeritus from Chico State University, author of 5 books on terrorism. And he has also got a webinar I'd like him to tell us about at the end of this segment. Bo Groskop, welcome to the Peace and Justice Show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So I wanted to, you had some questions you wanted me to ask you to sort of guide this discussion, but I was so alarmed yesterday when I saw that Putin had met with Xi Jinping of China, and their alliance is closer than ever. And what brought that about, Bo Groskop? What does it signify?
Well, I think that just signifies realization by both leaders that there is a emerging threat coming from the United States, and in particular, and maybe its allies, that is bringing us or headed us to a big power conflict. And so they have some common interest in that regard. And so, you know, it's always when we talk about big power conflicts, these are alliances of convenience. And so I think that's putting their heads together to see what they think the national security state of the United States is up to.
Yeah, so You know, this whole last few weeks have been so alarming, and I thought it would be really good if we could back up a little bit, and maybe you could tell us something about NATO and their move from a defensive posture, especially since they were supposed to be disbanded when the Warsaw Pact was disbanded in 1990. Can you tell us about NATO and its position post-war, World War II, and up to the current time?
Well, the notion of NATO being which is a common image of being in a defensive posture is a joke. Any military analyst or strategist will tell you that you always want to be on the offense, and that was also true of NATO. But it was important for the American public to think, as always, that the United States is never the aggressor, is always on the defensive, and only reacts to the aggression of others. There's this concept called the image of the aggressor, and if your listeners haven't done so already, from now on, I would encourage them to always think about that image of the aggressor as they try to understand U.S. foreign policy. There's a reason why at the end of World War II, the War Department, the Pentagon, was renamed from the War Department to the Defense Department, again, to support such imagery. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, the only thing that if NATO was in a defensive posture at all was because of the Warsaw Pact. That is, they had these two great powers who were standing off against, in Europe, this very valuable piece of territory, regardless of the destruction of World War II. They had divided Europe as a result of that war. And so we've seen that since the end of the Warsaw Pact, NATO has expanded from six nations to 30 nations and moved eastward, which I would argue is a definitive offensive posture.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, you know, a lot of times people used to hold signs at the vigils and about NATO and getting rid of NATO, and I never focused on NATO. It just seemed like a non-entity, and now it's so central to what may occur in Eastern Europe. Can you tell us also, Bo Groskop, about Gorbachev? There was that period of where the Cold War ended, and it seemed like we were going to be on a good footing with Russia. And anyway, tell us about that period of time when there was a plan or desire to disband NATO.
Well, if you remember, Gorbachev disbanded the Warsaw Pact unilaterally.
Mm-hmm.
And that was tied really to the unification of Germany, in which the Russians, very wary about a reunified Germany in the Central Europe. Historically, they've had some troubles there. And so they, first of all, said, okay, we agree to the reunification of Germany, but we don't want it, going around in Central Europe without any kind of controls on it. So obviously Gorbachev would have wanted it to join his alliance, the Warsaw Alliance, but he had started a policy of, which is known as the Frank Sinatra policy, of letting the Eastern European nations, the former Warsaw nations, Pact nations, you know, do it their way. In other words, he was relaxing tensions and Soviet control over them and influence. And yet he had a German problem. And so he allowed he allowed Germany to join NATO as a way of controlling Germany, because he knew that at that time the Bush administration would never allow Germany, reunified Germany, to join the Warsaw Pact. So that was the solution to that, and then he just disbanded the Warsaw Pact under the Frank Sinatra theory. Fact is, there were two plans to disband NATO, both engineered by an alliance between France and Germany, which is very interesting because France and Germany, as you know, historically have had their own troubles and still have their own troubles cooperating. But in fact, there were two plans to get rid of NATO. One was called the Pan-European Security Pact, which included the Soviet Union, thus Pan-European. The other plan was basically to set up two European security pacts, one orchestrated by the Soviet Union and the other orchestrated by the German and Russian and German and French collaboration. Both of those plans said NATO was gone. And you can imagine how the United States responded to them by saying, no, that's never going to happen. But both the Germans and the French were determined to get rid of NATO. They said it outlived its usefulness. And, of course, we know who won that battle, because NATO not only survives but has expanded, as we know, and wants to expand right up to the Russian borders in terms of the Ukraine situation.
All right. I want to ask you a little more about Germany. I know that, you know, with Angela Merkel leaving and Germany being somewhat dependent on Russia for fuel, they have tried to modify this situation where the U.S. is pressing for war. And I was wondering if you could say more about the French and German positions right now vis-a-vis putting this kind of pressure on Russia.
Well, first of all, they know that any war is going to happen in Europe, and it's going to devastate Europe first and foremost. So they're not interested in that. But really it comes down, Chris, to their view of NATO and their sort of wishy-washy commitment to NATO. And it goes back again to, their plans. Hey, we don't really need NATO. But the problem for the Germans and even the French, but basically the Germans, is that NATO is and always has been a U.S.-dominated security alliance in which the United States has the primary, foremost power in terms of determining the security situations in Europe. If you think about it in this term, well, the Germans and the French have often said or thought, United States, you have a role in the security of Europe as a part of this alliance. Now, we have this concept called the Atlantic Alliance, which means that there's a commonality in terms of interest between the Atlantic, over the Atlantic, the North American nations of Canada, the United States, and then Europe. Western Europe in particular, and you have not only a say, you have the biggest say in our security situation. So as partners, right, let's have us involve ourselves in the security issue of North America. And of course, the United States, you don't have any role in the security of the United States. That's for us to decide. So that's always been a trouble point between the European, France, and German in particular, and the United States. Secondly, though, there's this notion, and we often hear politicians talking about and criticizing NATO alliance partners on the burden-sharing issue. And they say, well, why aren't the Europeans, carrying their part in paying for NATO? And this is, the burden-sharing. They need to share more for the burden of paying for NATO and doing their part, and the Europeans we're willing to do that. We're willing to pay more if that's what you want. But this is never the second part is never mentioned by the U.S. But we want a greater say in the security of our own geopolitical area. And the United States has said no. We have the primary role in determining your security. We just want you to pay more for it. So that's undermined their commitment to NATO, because they do see it, whether they support NATO or not. And there are a lot of Europeans who do support NATO, But then on both the right and the left, there's always been this, again, well, who is it and should be responsible for the security of Europe? And it should be Europe for the Europeans.
Okay, so we're at KZFR. We're listening to terrorism expert Bo Grosskopf, who is a former host here on the Peace and Justice program. And, you know, you bring up a lot of thoughts I've been having is that, you know, the peace movement position is that NATO is there to serve the military-industrial complex, which is such a big part of the U.S. economy and is driving this and all of our policies pretty much. Your response to that, Bo?
Well, my thesis is that that the Biden administration, the national security state under the Biden administration, is clearly moving us, focusing us on a big power conflict again. And one could argue, and I believe there is a lot of credence to it, that the problem with the war on terror, I call it the war of terror by the United States, is that, you know, that's a small weapons war. You know, you're fighting these sort of proxy units, small units, and terrorist units, and you don't need the big missile systems and, you know, the big expensive weapon system, but you do if you're in a big power conflict. So one could make an argument that the so-called defense industry, the private defense industry, is going to benefit greatly by this focus on a big power conflict.
Yeah, this mobilization
that we seem headed for.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been reading about, I wouldn't call it Russian nationalism, just sort of the Russian history in terms of their relationship, and not just with Ukraine, but parts of Ukraine where there's more, you know, people who have Russian cultural roots. Can you talk a little bit about Russian, what they call Russian nationalism, and Putin's resistance to the NATO expansion, and especially Ukraine becoming a NATO member?
Well, let's start with the concept of nationalism, which we all seem to be or are supposed to be in love with. You know, Russia is a nation state, and, you know, so whether it's the jingoist interpretation of nationalism, my country right or wrong, America first, whatever it might be, or more sober patriotic, as they call it, patriotic view of nationalism, which, you know, we need to look out for our national interests vis-a-vis other nation states. Whatever, you know, the United States is not the only world that the only nation that operates under those principles of nationalism. And the Russians in particular are wary of the West. You know, if they historically, they've been invaded from the peaceful, nice West three times in the last century and a half, or two centuries now. And so they're a little bit wary of the promises coming from the West, whether it be the Europeans or the United States, in terms of their peaceful intentions. And what's happened here in terms of, you have to remember, Putin, whether you like him or not, and I'm not particularly fond of the guy as a national leader for the Russian people, but, you know, he is a Russian nationalist, and he understands that history, and he understands that if he wants to stay in power, as Gorbachev found out, you know, he's got to first and foremost protect the Russian nation state from all aggressors. And so that's really what's at play here, and why his resistance to NATO involvement in Ukraine. Ukraine is a border state of Russia. And so NATO has expanded, you know, this peaceful little NATO has expanded right up to his border, an important border in Central Europe. And by the way, they also are arming that nation state and are training that nation state's military. You have to ask for what purpose, and that's exactly what he's asking. And so finally, he's saying, okay, you know, you've expanded all the way up to my border now, and I have to make a stand. And if I don't make a stand, you know, we just don't trust your so-called peaceful interests. And if I don't make a stand, I'm out. Right. Because other Russian nationalists will say, you're not protecting the mother country, as they call it. So you know, this attempt by Ukraine or NATO to include NATO, Ukraine, is absolutely a no-no for any Russian leader. And it happens to be, at the moment, it happens to be Putin. And so he's massed troops along that border and said, this is our last stand, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, Russia, they have generations of links with Ukraine, linguistic, cultural, economic, political, and family ties. And even Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, was called the birthplace of their nation, of the Russian nation. And, Bo, I was wondering about some of these media voices. We never hear about the kind of the Russian side of things, you know, from their perspective. We never hear any anti-war voices in the media. And I'm wondering about whether you, as someone who has often been a pundit on different programs, has anyone reached out to you, or do you know of any way to express the things you've expressed today on the Peace and Justice Show in the wider arena of public media?
No, just the Peace and Justice Show on KZFR.
Dang. Well, you know, we're small but mighty, right?
But we're small but mighty.
Yes. You know, I wanted to just say something about Zelensky, who is the premier or president or whatever he is. And, you know, he's telling the United States to cool off and stop this, you know, but they're sending in troops. They've sent troops to Poland and Romania. Do you have anything else you want to say about this troop buildup or this pressure for Ukraine to join NATO and not backing down about how obviously fraught that is?
Well, it's a game of chicken right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we don't hear too much about is that, the fact is this is a U.S. enterprise. This is a Biden administration enterprise. And, you know, the European, other NATO nations, yeah, they're contributing things. I think, for example, I heard that the Germans have contributed 500 helmets in case there's a, you know, a war in the Ukraine. You can put your helmet on, you'll be safer. So that gives you an idea about, you know, the basic argument that the Biden administration is saying and echoed in the corporate media is, you know, Ukraine's government is a sovereign government. They should have a right to determine what they want to do. And, of course, that argument, you know, assumes that the Ukraine exists, or any nation state exists, in a political vacuum, in a power vacuum. And they do not. They have to take into account, you know, the power dynamics in their geopolitical region. And so this argument, oh, they should join NATO if they want to or not, you know, they're a sovereign nation, what's the big deal? And, you know, the fact is, interestingly, what Putin and the Russians are up to is not only saying this is the last stand, that Ukraine will not join NATO. What we're going to eventually figure out and what we're going to propose, in fact, they've sort of already proposed it, is what's called the Finland solution. You know, Finland is a border state with Russia, former Soviet Union, and they have worked out a situation in which the Russians have said to the Finnish government, look, your geopolitical situation on our border is very important to us, and as long as you can be Western-leaning, as long as if you want, but you can't join the alliance. You can't join a military alliance on our border. And the Finnish government understands that, understands the political realities of the political geographical realities of their situation, and they've abided by that. And they have come and go kind of relationship, but it's not a war situation. So I think in the end, this is exactly what Putin is offering the West, i.e. the Biden administration.
Right.
Whether they take it or not, I think they will. But again, I think the point here, Chris, is for the Biden administration as they pivot into this big power confrontation. You know, they've got to demonstrate to the American people, right, first of all, by the way, it is a diversion from our other difficulties, but to say to the American people, we can unify around something, and it's around these big powers who are threatening our security.
Bo Groskop, we're going to have to leave it, but I want you to hang on just one second. I want to tell people there's going to be a global day of action all around the country and all around, you know, Europe, too, tomorrow. And here in Chico, there will be at the Chico Peace Vigil from 12:30 to 1:30. Bring your own sign, or we'll have some for you also. If you're in other communities, I hope that you will also stand on a corner somewhere with a sign that says no war with Russia or whatever you want to say on your sign. And please join the rest of the planet as we stand up against this really insane nuclear nations here, and any slip could cause us annihilation. It's that serious. Some are saying it's as serious as the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, Bo, last thing I want to ask you, and we only have like a minute. You wrote this wonderful book with a Laverne Merritt Gordon called Tell Them What You Want, and it's her story, but it's about both of you as kids growing up in Ohio, and you're going to be doing an event. Can you just promote your event?
Yes, it's being sponsored by Miami University, which is in Oxford, Ohio, where we both grew up, and she went to school there. And it is entitled White on Black in Camelot. And Miami University and Oxford in particular has always pictured itself as Camelot, you know, this very wonderful, romantic, blissful, peaceful place to live. And it is a very nice place to live, I can tell you. But what we discovered what comes out in the book, Tell Them What You Want, is that Laverne's experience in Oxford was very different than the white professor's son, which is what I am. And so as part of the Black History program at Miami University, we have been asked to talk about her experience and my experience in this place called Camelot. Or pictured image is Camelot. And it will be on YouTube. That will be on February 8th, the webinar is. And it's a select group of people who are involved in that. But it will be on YouTube after that if people want to see it. It's an hour-long program, and it will be on YouTube under Miami University Libraries. I want to thank you, Chris, for interviewing both of us for that on that book about a year ago. You really did appreciate that.
Well, her story stays with me. It's very powerful. So thank you for writing it with her. The book is called Tell Them What You Want. Okay, Bo Groskop, we've got to leave it, but thank you for being my guest today on the Peace and Justice Program. Peace to you.
You're very welcome, and it's available at your local bookstore.
Yes. Good plug. Okay, bye, Bo.
Bye.
Okay, so I wanted to thank our underwriters for this. Everything that we do here at the station depends on underwriters and listeners. So we want to thank all of you, but I'd like to, at this particular juncture, thank Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with the Hightower Group specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with compassionate quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. Also like to thank Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And I'd like to thank the Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit ParadiseGuilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And you know now you have to use the area code 530. and by the bankruptcy law offices of Michael O. Hayes, a proud supporter of community radio. For more than 40 years, Michael O. Hayes has provided consultations for Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcies. You can reach Michael O. Hayes, who spells his last name H-A-Y-S, at 892-8916 and at mhayeslaw.com. So it is noon right now. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm going to segue with a song. This is a woman named Lisa Jeanette. Jellyfish on the Moon is the name of the CD, and I thought this was a pretty good song. Of course, I don't think that's it. Maybe.
War is dust, war is loud sound, war is boots upon the ground, but I've never been to war. War is miles of shifting sand, war is blood upon my hands, but I've never been to war. I've seen
My point, of course, here on the Peace and Justice Program is that we prevent war. It is the most important thing that we can do. So one of the aspects of war is the development, the R&D of war, and there's so much money in it, and we need to be watching what's coming, because what's coming is even more terrifying than what we already have. So here we are on the Peace and Justice Program, and I have on the line with me Rebecca Gordon. Rebecca Gordon received her PhD from Graduate Theological Union. Her latest book is American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. She publishes regularly at tomdispatch.com, which is a project of the Nation Institute. Prior to teaching at UC San Francisco, Rebecca spent many years as an activist in a variety of movements, including for women's and LGBTQ plus liberation, the Central American and South American solidarity movements, and for racial justice in the United States. Her course is focused on issues of war and peace, justice and collective responsibility, asking each other how we can change the world from here. Her websites, one of them is mainstreamingtorture.org, and you can find out more about her on Vox Populi. PopuliSphere.com, tag Rebecca-Gordon. Rebecca, it's good to have you on the Peace and Justice program today. Thank you for joining us. Hi.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you. I just one little correction. I teach at the University of San Francisco, which is a Jesuit university. It's not at UC San Francisco, which is mostly a medical school.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I got that wrong.
No worries.
Hey, that's
no worries.
Yeah, you know, you have this article that was passed around among some in the peace groups, and it was automated warfare is nothing new. It didn't just start with drones, and it won't stop with them. And that was in mid-January. And I found this to be such a terrifying article. I had to get a hold of you and want to talk about it more. I've been part of groups that have resisted drone warfare for over 10 years, and this robotic warfare is piloted, but it's remote, and it has huge moral ethical concerns about the surveillance, targeting, destruction of humans, their livelihoods in poor countries. And so I've... over the years, interviewed many people talking about drones, most recently Nick Modern, who's with the group BanKillerDrones.org.
Mm-hmm.
And now I learned about I've heard about it, but automated warfare using robotics. And so you go back 50 years with this topic. So, Rebecca.
Oh, my gosh. I am older than I thought.
Well, you said 1972. I think that's the math.
No, it's true.
Yeah. So, tell us about your own history with automated battlefields.
All right. So, in 1972, I found myself spending a semester at Barnard College, which is the women's college that is associated with Columbia University in New York. And I spent a large portion of that spring occupying the physics building because there was a group of us on campus who were trying to get a group of five physicists to stop working with a special Defense Department program called the JASON Initiative. And what this was an initiative that provided lab space and money for physicists to do basic research into things that could turn out to be useful to the Department of Defense. And what some of the people there at Columbia were working on was what was called the automated battlefield. And this was an attempt to deal with the major problem the U.S. was having in the middle of the war in Vietnam. So some of your listeners may not remember that war, but one of the things that happened with that war was that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, those who were fighting to overthrow the essentially colonially supported government in South Vietnam, they were able to move so much war material and people through what was called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which went along the borders of Laos and Cambodia from North Vietnam into South Vietnam. And the trail wasn't really a trail. It was a whole series of paths through the jungle, dirt roads, river transportation, and underground tunnels where people used bicycles. But they were able to move all of this material, and the trail was covered with this thick jungle so that U.S. planes couldn't see what was underneath and they couldn't see people moving. So the idea was to create an automated battlefield that would plant sensors all along the trail. These could be acoustic sensors, so listening for sounds like truck ignitions. They could be chemical sensors, literally sensing human urine, and seismic sensors so that they could feel the rumbling of trucks going along. And the idea was that these sensors would send information back to a central nerve system in Thailand, and that once the information that there were people there became known, there would be an automatic process of dispatching armed planes that were piloted by real human beings to go over to the area where the sensor had gone off and drop bombs to kill whoever was underneath and had tripped the sensor. This was the theory. In reality, it never really worked. The sensors turned out to only have about a 20-mile radius, which meant that they had to constantly fly planes up and down to receive the signals and then relay the signals back to the nerve system that, in theory, would use this state-of-the-art mainframe IBM computer and an army of programmers to send the information to a pilot that they should go up and drop a bomb somewhere. But by that time, whatever took the sensor was long gone. But this became the model for what the Department of Defense wanted in the future, was a system that would take the human element out of targeting and killing the enemy and create a system that was really, in the long run, the hope was a system that was totally automated in which no human being would have to be involved.
Right.
So our goal was to stop this.
Right. And, of course, it didn't discriminate between soldiers and civilians. And I'd like to, so we have enough time to fast forward to 2021. And
yeah.
You write, the role of lethal autonomous weapons systems is to automatically find and kill human beings. Can you tell us about lethal autonomous weapons systems?
Absolutely. This is the official language, so the acronym is LAWS, that is used when nations are discussing these kinds of weapons. And the picture you might have is of the Terminator, a giant robot that's controlled by Skynet, an eye in the sky. But what these systems are much more likely to be is little tiny things the size of your cell phone or a dinner plate, drones that are not piloted, that can be controlled automatically by a computer at a distance. And as long as these drones have the capacity to sense something, to send a signal, to receive a signal, and then to do something lethal, usually that lethal thing would be to blow themselves up by falling into or attacking a target. And lest you think this is the stuff of science fiction, it already exists. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Turkish government contracted with a company that on its website used to have a description of exactly this kind of weapon. They have since removed that description, and they now say that they always maintain a, quote, human in the loop. But the United Nations believes that some of these completely autonomous drones were actually deployed by Turkey in Libya in 2020. Hmm. So these things not only exist, they've been used already.
Yeah. So they initially are programmed by humans, but once they have their coding, then they just continue to kill until they are destroyed. Is that how it works?
That's pretty much it. And the thing about the coding, of course, is that it's done by human beings. And we know, because we have seen, that algorithms created by human beings inevitably incorporate the biases of those human beings. So, for example, we've seen algorithms in facial recognition that do a much worse job recognizing African-American faces than white faces. We know that these algorithms are imperfect. And even if they were perfect, they could very easily be programmed to do something like kill everyone of a particular skin color or everyone who has a particular signature of behavior, a certain kind of behavior. And we know how bad this is, and you know this from the work that you've done with the drones, because one of the things the CIA did was to try to create the idea that it was all right to order signature drone strikes, which are drone strikes not based on knowing that an actual human being you want to target, which is bad enough, is there, but just based on certain kinds of behavior. And this is how drones have ended up blowing up wedding parties and wedding convoys where people are shooting their guns in the air because they were identified as having the signature of terrorism and terrorist activity. The same thing can happen with these, except there's no human intervention. Once the programming is done and the weapon is unleashed, that's it. There's no more control.
And there's not even a kill switch then. There's nothing.
No.
Yeah.
Nothing.
So let's move right on to international law. I'm hoping that there's a way that this can be quashed. This Pandora's box is just too far open to give one any rest at all.
We have to remember that the last item in Pandora's box was hope. Mm. And that's really important. But you're right. So the international law that covers this is probably international humanitarian law, which is the strange word, the strange language that governs law in warfare. So this is specifically the Geneva Conventions and a part of the convention called the 1980 UN Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons. And it's usually abbreviated as CCW. And this is the law that outlaws the convention that outlaws certain kinds of weapons, like using napalm as an anti-personnel weapon, or using biological warfare or chemical warfare. And usually these are outlawed because they cannot be, because they elude human control after they're deployed, like autonomous weapons, or because you can't control how they spread, or because there's no kill switch, like a biological weapon. And this is the arena in which these laws, these lethal autonomous weapon systems, fall. And so there's been a lot of negotiation ongoing, and this convention on certain weapons meets every year or so with the 50 countries that have signed on to it, and also with a bunch of non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and others, to try to see whether the law needs to be refined and whether, in this case, it should include some prohibitions on laws. Our country, the United States, has routinely stood against that. They've stood against including laws automatically, and they've stood against even defining what a lethal autonomous weapon system is. Because once it's been defined, presumably it can be outlawed. And so in the meetings, they've been arguing against these things. And just as you know, one of the other ones that is considered a certain conventional weapon is landmines. And as you know, most countries in the world have signed on against landmines, which in their own way are a lethal autonomous weapon. You plant it, and when the trigger happens, it goes off, and there's nobody to stop it. But the U.S. has not signed on to the anti-landmine conventions either. Hmm. We are holding on to the right to deploy these things.
So last year, the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was signed, and people all over the world rejoiced because even though the signatory nations were non-nuclear states, they still feel that there's some normative effect, just like with these other cluster bombs and the mines, the landmines that you mentioned, that is going to take place because of this. So this is a really important thing. Can you tell us more about this process so that we can have enough information that we can get involved in it?
Absolutely. And I think you're so right to mention the nuclear agreement because, and you're exactly right, what it has is normative value. In other words, it creates a norm, a moral, legal norm out there. And I think it's our only hope is international law at this point. And so, yeah, the way it works is they have these meetings. And usually the month before they have the meeting, there's this group of governmental experts that comes together, and they try to then come together with recommendations that the actual group of who do the CCW or certain conventional weapons meetings will do. So the place where we can have power is in those GGE meetings, where there is a big space for non-governmental organizations. And the key group is something called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, which is a coalition of 180 organizations, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the World Council of Churches. They have a website. You can just Google Campaign to Stop Killer Robots, and they have recommendations for actions that people can take locally, including letter-writing campaigns, but also holding workshops so that your local peace organization can really learn about this issue and how to have an effect on this issue. So I strongly recommend that your listeners visit the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots and see what the actions are that are open to them.
Yeah. Okay, so that is stopkillerrobots.org, folks, and I hope that some people who are listening are interested in getting more involved in this because, you know, there is a future that may not have some of us in it because of our political views or because of the color of our skin or, you know, our sexual orientation. We don't know how these things could be used in the future. I saw some little scary show where a young man had put up a poster and he was sitting in his classroom and this swarm of little drones came in and killed him. And, you know, there was no judge, jury, there was nothing other than than this murder. And this is how it can go. I mean, it is absolutely our worst nightmare. So, again, stopkillerrobots.org, and I'm speaking with Dr. Rebecca Gordon, and she has been writing about this and is standing up for it for the last 50 years. So is it working? So there's a lot of money in this. There has been investments of billions of dollars in developing autonomous weapons. Can you tell us who is doing the development and maybe some other pressures that we might apply on that side of things?
That's a really good question. And the truth is, apart from this company in Turkey called Kargu, K-A-R-G-U, I don't really know, but my guess is it's the usual suspect. It's going to be your Boeings, your Lockheeds, your Rockwells. Those are going to be the people who are doing it because that's who develops our weapon systems. And actually, that's a good piece of research that somebody needs to do to take a look at who is actually developing these. There is a man named Stuart Russell who gave the annual Reef lectures for the BBC last year, and he is the founder of the Center for Human Compatible Artificial Intelligence at the University of California at UC Berkeley. And he is somebody who is very concerned about this issue and I think would be a very good research. So that's Stuart Russell at UC Berkeley. And he probably knows more than he was able to say in just his half-hour lecture about who is doing this work. But, yeah.
I just want to say this quote that you put in your article. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, machines with the power and discretion to take human lives without human involvement are politically unacceptable, morally repugnant, and should be prohibited by international law. So this is such an important issue. Rebecca Gordon, I don't want to pass over some of the work that you did after 9/11 to try to inform people about the U.S. torture program and to hold U.S. officials accountable for many of the war crimes that were committed by our countrymen. I was wondering, in light of that, your understanding of war and war hype, what you are experiencing or feeling right now or working on in regard to this unrelenting U.S. push for war with Russia?
This is absolutely terrifying. And I think you and I may not agree entirely about where the fault lies, but I think there's enough fault to go around both between Russia and the United States. Russia is absolutely feeling encircled by NATO and has indicated this for some years and has tried to signal to the United States that they feel insecure because they are both physically surrounded and because of the placement of certain missiles very close to Russia. So I understand that point of view. On the other hand, I also understand the point of view of people living in Ukraine and the desire not to be invaded. And my concern at this point is that once people start preparing for war and have invested a certain amount in it, and that includes the U.S. as well as Russia, that's a momentum that becomes harder and harder to stop the longer it goes on. And I'm really terrified that this is going to happen almost by accident, mm-hmm. that there's going to be some minor event that is going to provoke one or the other side to move. And I think this is one of the most frightening periods we've been in for a long time. As somebody who grew up in the in the shadow of the threat of nuclear war, we have rarely been in such a dangerous situation as we are now. And I think our government needs to hear that whatever Russia is willing to do, we are not willing to support a war in Europe, that a war that could engulf the entire continent. Mm. And that just really scares me.
Yeah, me too. Rebecca Gordon, I'm going to leave you now, but do you want to promote any particular other websites besides the StopKillerRobots.org or any other actions?
So this is totally out of left field, but I'm also a union organizer for my part-time faculty association. And if you want to take a look at USFPTFA.org, that's the part-time faculty association. We are currently locked in a bitter contract campaign with our administration. And anything students and other people want to do to support the people who teach most students in universities these days, that would be wonderful.
Website, I didn't get it. Go ahead.
Sure. It's USFPTFA.org, and that's the University of San Francisco Part-Time Faculty Association.
Mm, okay.
And we want is 2% pay increase this year and next year, and they're saying they don't have the money for it.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much and for your many years of teaching. I can tell just from talking to you this brief time how much you've given to your students, because you've given so much to us folks up here in Northern California who need this education. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It was a real pleasure.
All right. Peace to you. Bye-bye.
And to you. Bye-bye.
Okay. So we are in the Peace and Justice program. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My old brain can't remember if I said it at the top of the hour. And always, the opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. They're just my own and my guests. And we're going to move on to our third guest, and please stay tuned, and I'll have another song for you. And this is from an old CD that was a compilation that's called Take Me Home, a sampler of American Artists for Peace. And the guy's name is Jim Stringer. So hang with me here. I think he's gone to sleep. He's tired. Hang on. I'm going to wake this guy up. One sec.
There was a war, the last war, though at the time nobody knew. It was just what they called it, like the Gulf War or World War II. Last in the sense of previous, like the one before the next. Last meaning final, nobody knew. It was not used in the context.
It pitted woman on man, and nation on nation. The last war buried an entire generation. No one was spared for the colors that he wore. Not the rich, not the poor. In the last war. Made few heroes and many a villain. In the years that followed, tempers flared. But nobody seemed willing. No, for once, enough blood had spilled for a megalomaniac's petty coup d'etat. Not one more daughter or brother would die, however low or noble the cause. The survivors of the last war vowed they'd never forget, and would teach the coming generations well the transgressions and the threat. But to those born after the last war, the devastation seemed ancient and remote. The once young, virile battle cry aged and became a senile quote. It pitted woman on man and nation on nation. The last war buried an entire generation. No one was spared for the colors that he wore. Not the rich, not the poor. In the last war. Years after the last war, the ground that the bombs had shook was grown back with trees, and the war was just a chapter in a history book. And like the last of the generation that over the war's dead had cried, the last war was soon a paragraph, then a sentence, and then it died.
Goodness, that is difficult to hear that song. My name is Chris. Again, this is the Peace and Justice Show, and I am not coming through my headphones, so I'm going to have to move the headphones. And just give me one second here, folks. All right, let's see if that's better. Not really. Okay, there. Now I can hear myself. So, the Peace and Justice Show, like I said, is here with us every Friday, 11:30 to 1. Robert Jones is my co-host. He'll be here with you the third Friday, and he has some really important interviews coming up, and I hope that you will listen when he's on, too. And let people know about this show, because we have such important guests, and a lot of times I don't know how good the listenership is, but the show, it will be archived, and I will post it on Facebook, on the Facebook page for the show, KZFR Peace and Justice Program. I have on the line with me someone who's relatively new to her job, but she sounds incredible. She's done great work so far. Her pronouns are she, they, and it's Justina J. Sotella. She is a new addition to Stonewall Alliance into the Chico area. Born and raised in California, she moved to New York City after graduating college and worked as a high school educator for the past 4 years. Their transition to the nonprofit world was inspired by 7 years of experience as a community organizer and advocate. Justina is excited to dive into their role as the events coordinator and looks forward to familiarizing herself with local residents, organizations, and businesses that all efforts to best serve her new Stonewall community. Welcome to Peace and Justice, Justina, and to KZFR.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so glad to have you. I'm just so impressed by the work that's gone into the pop-up that's going to take place on Saturday. It's a Black History Month parking lot pop-up event. And I'd just like you to go ahead and hit it. Tell us all about what's happening tomorrow from 10 to 2.
Yeah, it is the first time Stonewall has partnered with AAFCC on a Black History Month event. And so that's exciting for one. Two, we are working in our direct parking lot right behind us, and we were able to navigate a safe event in the middle of a pandemic. We're mandating masks. We have COVID tests available. We also have an on-site vaccination. And so if anyone is interested in getting fully vaxxed or if they need their booster shot, that is free service offered by NVIH. And I want to name that because I know there's a lot of hesitancy in coming to large-scale events or just events in general. But just know that we at Stonewall and AAFCC are all being super conscious about that and doing the best to keep our community safe. But besides that, we have a lot of fun things going out there. We are centering the Black community in this event. And so all of our vendors who are spotlighted on our flyers, all of our performances who are spotlighted, and all our community groups who are spotlighted are all members of the Black community. We have a performance lineup to kick us off starting at around 10:30, which includes spoken word poetry, includes live musicians. We have a live DJ. We have dancers who are coming out. And we also have a street artist who will be painting in the back of the parking lot. So that lineup starts again around 10:30 and will last till about 11:30. We have vendors who are selling food as well as handmade arts. And so vendors like Beads by Ray, Jay Threads, Hoots by Anastasia, we even have a braiding artist who will be out in the parking lot. And, of course, the food will also be there. Black Wall Street, Adriana's Bakery, and Clea Cuisines will be selling their food at the event. And so it is a hodgepodge of things that kind of grew from a small idea, but we are super excited to put on the event and really get folks out there supporting the Black community.
Yeah, it sounds so much work went into it, and it really follows on the theme for this year's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. celebration, where, you know, is focused on the economy and African American strength in the economy. So it's really supporting a lot of people, small businesses as well as artists and performers. And I'm so glad to see this. You also have a direct aid fundraiser for QTPOC people. What is that?
Yeah, so this is something that came out of I wasn't here for the planning, and so, but from what I understand of the QTPOC Direct Aid Fund, it is a way that we are helping with direct economic relief to queer, trans people of color. The pandemic hit many folks, but when we think about our most vulnerable and our most marginalized communities, queer, trans folks fall into that category, and more specifically, folks of color. And so this Direct Aid Fund is geared directly to them. They can apply online. It's a pretty easy application, very straightforward. If there's any difficulty navigating the Stonewall site, feel free to pop in. We have office hours. We also have a phone number here. So for folks who are interested and fall into that category to receive direct aid, the number is 530-893-3336. That's our Stonewall office. And we can help get that on the board for you. We want to make sure that this aid is accessible, which is why I wanted to take the time to offer that phone number there for folks if they can't, again, navigate the online site. But it's a great fund. So far, we've rewarded over $4,000 to members in the Butte community. And so, again, this is direct economic aid. We're not asking for a paper trail at all. We are essentially entrusting our community members to do what they need to do to take care of themselves and make sure that they're well, healthy, and have the funds to do that.
That's so important. You know, direct aid is so important because whenever there's a middleman or there's a big paper trail or, you know, you have to jump through a bunch of hoops, people get lost. They don't benefit. And so this is, I'm really glad to hear about this fund. I didn't know about it before, but I'm grateful for Stonewall. And with Stonewall Alliance, you say you're new there, but can you tell us a little bit about your services in case anyone in our listening area is not aware of Stonewall Community?
Yeah, the Stonewall Alliance of Chico is located here in the downtown area. We're right across the street from Tender Loving's, which is a popular coffee shop. We offer a variety of services. We offer gender-affirming care, which includes binders in office that we give out for free. You can also try them on here if you're wanting to do that. We offer gender name changes as well. I know navigating that legal escapade can be a lot, and so we have someone on staff who is trained, who has done this a lot, and Marin is more than happy to help folks on that. We also offer support in social groups. We had just yesterday our teens LGBTQIA plus group in office here, and so that is, again, a teen group. We also have a trans teen group specifically that comes into office, and we have a new group, which is the Daring Dinos, and that is a 4 to 12 age group. Mm-hmm. So, again, those supportive groups are slowly coming into office. Again, we are super mindful of the pandemic, and so we just want to make sure that we have every technology we can to have folks be safe. We also offer social groups for parents of LGBTQIA plus teens and young adults. That's how we navigate that. That is a support group. They meet online in Zoom, and they also meet once a month in person. All of this information can be found online, stonewallchico.org. You'll see our groups page. You'll see our information about advocacy work. We also offer testing here in office by appointment. So again, you can call that number. You can email the center, which is center@stonewallchico.org. And that will take you to someone who will answer you and set you up with an appointment, whether that is gender name changing, binders, whether that is just a question about the center, a question about the groups. We now are fully staffed here, and so I was a new addition as well as our center coordinator, Marissa. And so now there are a full staff of folks ready to reengage with the community as best as we can.
And it sounds very dynamic, too. It's so great that you're giving support to young people. And I'm wondering, when you talked about COVID and you talked about the difficulties of bringing people together during the pandemic, how has Stonewall managed it? I mean, have you been doing Zoom meetings with people, or how are people getting their needs met for, especially, knowing others and, mm-hmm. you know, emotional support and things that especially so important to all of us, but especially to young people?
Yeah, I'm thinking about at the start of the pandemic and navigating that year and a half of at-home orders. And a lot of folks were suffering with mental health issues for the first time, having to navigate that, missing community, missing seeing other folks besides those who were in their pods. And so throughout all of that, Stonewall was mindful of what was going on, and they actually upticked their Zoom conferences, which was actually a great move because Butte County is fairly large, but we have a huge NorCal reach as well. Stonewall's reach, because we're one of the largest, and I say largest hesitantly there, because there are five of us on staff, but nonetheless, our impact goes way into NorCal. We help serve the surrounding communities. And so through Zoom, we got a lot of folks coming in who wouldn't be able to access the center because of distance. And so that was really cool to see. And that is part of the reason why a lot of our groups are still on Zoom. And so if someone is interested on a social group or one of our community groups, I know four of them are still operating on Zoom. And so we're still offering that for folks who don't feel quite comfortable going into large spaces. But still want to see, interact, and feel that sense of community. In terms of navigating COVID here in office, while we've opened up, we started with teens because they already have exposure at high schools, at middle schools, right? They're already interacting with one another. And so we thought it was a great group to kind of pilot our safety systems. We also, I'm staring right now at our air filters, which is a cool technology grant that we have that just circulates the room and makes sure everything is cleared out. We are still considered a health center because we offer the testing. We offer services that contribute directly to aid mental health. And so we are operating that way with full masks. We have N94 masks to give out if you don't have one. We have COVID tests available if you need that. So, again, we are doing all we can to keep our community safe and still keep us open and operating.
I'm speaking with Justina Sotella. She, they, is a very important events coordinator at Stonewall and obviously a very dynamic person. And I'm really appreciating talking to you because I can feel your energy and I can just know that, you know, people all over our listening area are hearing you. And especially in the rural areas where people might feel so isolated, you know, that there's something for them, that there's something for folks that are, you know, sometimes new to being a QT, I can never do it, I'm sorry, you know, who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, gender fluid, the whole spate of humanity, you know, who aren't just cisgendered heterosexual people. We are a rainbow people, and it's really important that people have access to other people who think and feel and communicate and style the way they do, you know. So this is just so great. I don't know if I said that very well, Justina. Please forgive me if I said it terribly. But I want to get back. We're down to our last 15 minutes here on the Peace and Justice program. Playing Dead comes up at 1 o'clock, followed by Devastation Sound. So I want folks to please stay tuned for a really chill afternoon after the intensity of this show, especially in the first two segments. But Justina Sotello, I want you to maybe take us back. I know we didn't say... We talked about the Black History Month parking lot event, but we didn't say... We know that it's from 10 to 2, and it's on the Stonewall lot, but the Stonewall lot is Orient and 6th Street. So I wanted our listeners to hear that. But also, can you just run through it again a little more slowly in terms of the businesses, artists, and performers, and kind of the lineup if somebody has somebody that they especially want to hear, or is there like a, you know, a timeline?
Yeah, I can go through the lineup. This was something I was really excited about organizing. I'd seen that once we started to reach out to folks and ask directly community members from AAFCC, that we got a lot of these spoken word poets that we wouldn't have had access to had it not been for our partnership with AAFCC, and that is the African American Family Cultural Center in Oroville. And so I want to give them a little shout out there. We owe a lot of this work to them. And we were so lucky to partner with them for the event. I'm very excited for tomorrow. In terms of performances, we will have Corey Kemp Hunt, who will be doing spoken word, Scout the Wise, who will be performing live music, Dr. Lisa Johnson from Chico State, who will be speaking at the event. Simbala will be performing in our back lot, doing some street art. Daylene will be speaking as a poet. We have David Phillips, who will be speaking as well. Mm-hmm. Taifa, spoken word poet. And then lastly, our dance group from, the dance group from AAFCC, Dance Diverse, which is a group that is still accepting members. I'm not too sure of their timeline, but they will be there. And if you have questions and you want to get your kiddo involved in a dance group, they seem very fun, and so excited to see that.
That is so great. It's so great. I want to give you the last word, Justina. Tell us anything that you think is important for a general listening audience here in the Chico North State area. What would you want people to know, either about your job or about the conditions in the world? Our focus is justice.
That's a big ask there.
I know.
I'll speak back on the event here. When we were first planning the event, we were starting with the idea of starting with something around MLK weekend and celebrating that holiday with our community. But in doing some further research, I myself made the proposal that we should move it to February and surround it around Black AIDS and HIV Awareness Day. It's very in line of what we do here at the center. The Black trans community is highly affected by the AIDS epidemic still. And so we wanted to highlight that as well. And so Black AIDS awareness and Black AIDS, HIV and AIDS awareness is February 7th. Mm. And so at this event, not only we are acknowledging Black History Month and that legacy, but we are also acknowledging that February 7th date as well. And so in thinking about planning this event, I wanted to just make sure that is known as well. And then also that no one on our staff identifies within the Black community. But when we say Black Lives Matter, when we want to support our Black community, we have to uplift in partnership. It's not alone to just take the stage. It's not our voice. It's not our mic that matters at this moment. And that is why we are partnering with our groups. And we also want to acknowledge the intersectionality within the LGBTQIA+ community. Black folks are there. Gay folks and queer folks are everywhere. And so we want to make sure that we are supporting both groups in partnership.
Thank you so much. I'm just so impressed with your ability to articulate those things. I bow to you. Thank you so much, Justina Sotelo, for not only being our guest today on the Peace and Justice Program, but for your leadership role as events coordinator at Stonewall Alliance Chico.
Thank you, and I hope to see many of the folks there.
I'll be there. Peace to you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
All right, so... we have a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to review again that there will be a global day of action to stop war between the U.S. and Russia. And you may think, oh, we don't matter, but we do matter. And we know that from past conflicts that when people got into the streets in large numbers, it affected things. And I know that the Biden administration is watching. They are very public consciousness about how they're seen. So it's very important that you call the White House, that you call your representatives and say no to war. No matter what you think about, you know, Russia, you know, if you have, you know, confusion or you think, oh, I don't know enough to say anything. All you have to say, no, I do not support, you know, war with Russia. And it will... You know, the diplomacy aspect is really sorely lacking here. It's also lacking. We are not hearing anything in the media about diplomacy. They have withdrawn the diplomatic corps from Ukraine, showing that they don't really have an investment in diplomacy. So it's our job to push for the things that we want, and that would be diplomacy. So... Peace and Justice, the Chico Peace Endeavor Vigil at 12:30 to 1:30 Saturday, corner of 3rd Street and Main here in Chico, and hopefully in other communities that might be within sound of my voice. And if you go to Code Pink's website, they have a lot about it, and all the other peace groups are posting about it too. So wherever you find your alternative news that have to do with peace and justice, go there, read that. Okay. Now, I wanted to also say that a lot of people are talking about this pallet shelter project in Chico, which it may be up as soon as the end of the month. They don't know exactly who's going to be administering this program, but it provides 177 pallet shelters for unhoused people in Chico, and it's as a result of a settlement agreement between the city of Chico and Legal Services of Northern California representing plaintiffs in the unhoused community here in Chico. So people have been asking, what's the best way to get into a pallet shelter? And recommendations at this point, although this may not be true, it seems like it is very likely to help, is the best recommendation at this point is for them to call 211 and ask to be entered into coordinated entry and to be evaluated for their vulnerability index. So there's this score that you get, and this vulnerability index will help you or a friend or someone you know be able to get a pallet shelter. Hopefully there's going to be enough pallet shelters to go around of those that are wish to live in one, but this is one way to get your foot in the door. So again, coordinated entry and vulnerability index. All right, so... I was happy to hear that Corey Hemphunt is going to be reading from his poetry at the Black History Month parking lot pop-up event. Again, that's 10 to 2 on the Stonewall lot, Orient and 6th Street tomorrow. And also tomorrow, people will be at the Safeway in on Nord, and they are working on the recall election for the mayor, Andrew Coolidge. And it is possible to go by there if you're in District 5 and sign that recall petition so that it can be on the June ballot, and the people can decide if this is really the right person for to be representing us on the Chico City Council. And, okay, and I have, of course, 16 other things here. One important thing that happened this month is protesters are suing the Sacramento Police Department for repressing racial justice protesters with violence, surveillance, and home raids. And this is a pretty important thing because demonstrators were so brutalized by the Sacramento Police Department who were there to stop them from protesting after George Floyd was murdered. And so plaintiffs have gone through so much, and a lot of them are still suffering from PTSD as a result of what they went through. They had violence against them, surveillance, home raids for months after engaging in anti-racist protesting. So this suit seeks to end the city's discriminatory violent attacks against anti-police brutality protests. And this has been taken on by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area and other firms. And so this is an important thing to follow. And you can follow it on the Davis Vanguard. DavisVanguard.org is a good source of news in the Sacramento area, because this is precedent setting how this comes out. And I want you, again, stay tuned for Playing Dead. Ray Lager is in the house, and just wanted to mention, when I see Ray Lager, I think about the Tuscan Water District, which was passed by LAFCO. I'm not going to explain all this to you, because I, of course, will goof it up. But basically, our water is being privatized by large landowners, that some of them don't even live here locally. There's a huge concern about that. And I'm going to go out with a Tracy Chapman song about that if I have time. And I think maybe I will make time here, but let's thank our underwriters and move in that direction. The Peace and Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of all of you, of course, and Pearl Consulting, offering digital branding and marketing to attract and connect with your ideal client. From websites and logos to social media, owner Sarah Fontaine provides comprehensive branding solutions for your online presence to bring you the business you're looking for. Visit pearlconsulting.tech or call 530-588-7505 to get started with Pearl Consulting. Also wanted to let you know about Chico Performances. They're presenting the stand-up comedian, artist, writer, producer, director, and musician Dimitri Martin on Sunday, February 6th at 7:30 in Laxon Auditorium. Dimitri Martin's deadpan delivery, music, and cartoons creates a unique and original blend of comedy. Tickets for Dimitri Martin are available at the University Box Office or at 898-6333 or at chicoperformances.com. And I'm going to play you the community calendar and then see if I can fit in a little bit of that song. Mainly the song I wanted to play is The Rape of the World by Tracy Chapman. If I don't get to it, you can hum it to yourselves, because some of you might know it. Sorry. And I wish you great peace. Despite the drums of war, we've got to find peace. So get out into nature and do your self-care, and know that a lot of us care about you. Here we go.
Hey, listeners. It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. This Saturday, February 5th, Stonewall Chico and their partner, the African American Family and Cultural Center, are presenting the Black History Month parking lot pop-up. Come support local Black small businesses, artists, and performers, and buy a special hand-printed Stonewall tee to help replenish the QTPOC Direct Aid Fund. This event will feature music, live performance, arts and crafts for sale, and delicious food, plus a free on-site COVID-19 vaccine booster clinic and free on-site HIV and hepatitis C testing. They're still adding to their lineup, so if you know a Black vendor or artist who should be a part of this, email Justina, JUSTINA at StonewallChico.org. Spread the word and join this special event in honor of National Black HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. This event will take place in the parking lot of Stonewall Alliance, located at 358 East 6th Street, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. this Saturday, February 5th. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
Alrighty, thank you, Chris, for another show. My name's Ray. It's time for Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 to 3. Got a really really excellent recorded show for you today. January 30th, 1978, Uptown Theater, Chicago, Illinois. And just really killer, really nice recording. So we're going to get into that here in just a minute. Let's thank our underwriters, and we'll get right to it. I hope everybody that went to Dark Star on Monday had a great time. Saw the set list. I couldn't make it myself, but 76 show. That's all I got to know. So kind of wishing I did, but what are you going to do? All righty, let's thank Chico Natural Foods, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, organic groceries, and cold brewed coffee. Co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico, and by Alternative Energy Systems, providing sustainable energy for life. Alternative Energy Systems offers solar, battery storage, and whole home generation solutions. More information at 530-342-6980, or visit SavingEnergyForLife.com. Alrighty, let's get right to it. Like I said, fun show today, and hope you guys enjoy it. Check